head into the Ringerverse to stay up to date with all things superheroes and nerd culture entertainment. Hosted by a rotating lineup of superfans at The Ringer, including Mallory Rubin and Van Lathan, shows will provide instant reactions to blockbuster releases, insightful backstories on canon, and mind-bending theories, as well as fresh takes on the latest news and rumors. Check out The Ringerverse on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey everybody, welcome back. This is Larry Wilmore. You are tuned in to Black on the Air. It is nice to have you here, everybody. Hope you guys are doing well. In this month of October, we're barreling towards the holidays already. Man, it comes too fast. I am never ready for it. But we have a really, really fun episode today with Jay Ellis, of course, Lawrence on Insecure, and Walter Thompson Hernandez, writer for the New York Times. They're talking about a new project, a podcast that they have called Written Off, where they have some formerly incarcerated young writers presenting their vulnerable poems and honest stories with celebrities reading them and that kind of stuff. It's really a great program, and we get in and talk about that, and I hope you enjoy it. It's a really cool conversation. So, man, there's so much bullshit happening in the world right now. It's just exhausting, too, to try to cover it all. I'm like, which one do you talk about? I'll tell you what I try to do, you guys. And you know this from me, for people that listen to me a lot. If I can give a new insight or a different angle to something, that's when I like to weigh on it. If I feel like I'm just saying the same things that other people are saying, then I'm like, I don't know. Like, I wondered if I should weigh in on the Kyrie Irving stuff for you basketball fans out there. Kyrie Irving plays for Brooklyn Nets. Has always been, let's just say kindly, has not always been in the mainstream of what we would consider groupthink for obvious things like the shape of the world. You know, I think he was a flat earther at one point or that type of thing. Kyrie's in kind of a world of his own. Not saying that Kyrie is dumb or stupid or that type of thing. I think he's a very thoughtful person, Kyrie Irving. He does a lot for his community. I know that. He's always been said to be a really nice guy. He's very, you know what the word is? Kyrie is very eccentric. He's very eccentric. You don't know which way he's going to move on something, you know? And to me, usually, and I'll tell you, here's the thing. Kyrie, let's put it this way. What Kyrie does for a living, he's a genius at, okay? He's a genius basketball player. And there are a lot of geniuses out there who are just eccentric. And I think Kyrie is an eccentric. I think that's the best way to put it. Okay, so let's talk. Here's what his situation is. So he has not gotten vaccinated. And as we talked about last week, the basketball players, you know, the way the league has handled it, there's not a league mandate for vaccinations. And remember when I talked about it last week, that the players were interestingly kind of conservative with their views on vaccinating, whether it was LeBron James or Draymond Green from Golden State. They were saying, look, I thought about this. I did what was best for me and for my family. You know, I don't think I have the right to tell another player what they should do. I made the decision of what's best for me. That's what LeBron said. That's what Draymond Green said. That's what another couple of players said. But their conclusion was that they should get vaccinated. That was the end of it. So nobody said anything. They were like, oh, okay, cool. But I'm just making the point that I pointed out that this is an interesting position. They're not advocating, you know, for people to get vaccinated, which you would think would be a good thing to do. Like, people were hoping LeBron James would say, hey, guys, please get vaccinated. Please, please, please. You know, there are so many people of color. so many just vulnerable people, whether age or whatever, who are dying from this, get that first level of protection. You know, it's not the be all end all, but it is the first level of protection. Get vaccinated. No, LeBron said, who am I to tell anybody? I did what's best for my family, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I just found that very interesting. So Kyrie Irving basically has said the same thing. I got to do what's best for me. I'm thinking about what's best for my family. And I choose not to get vaccinated. Man. So when he came to the different conclusion at the end, the world went crazy. Stephen A. Smith is calling him stupid and he's selfish and he's only thinking about himself and all this stuff. And all these people came out. I think Jay Williams, who's on ESPN, is the only one who kind of said, hey, guys, there's another way to look at this, you know. But it's interesting to me because he said the exact same thing that the other people said, that I'm thinking about what's best for me and my family. That's how he started it. He said, I'm not anti-vax. I just choose not to do it at this point. The caveat in all of this, for those of you not following, is that because he's not vaccinated, I believe it's the state of New York, you have to show proof of vaccination in order to be like at the Barclays Center where they play. And they have half of their games are home games, so he wouldn't be able to play in those home games unless you show proof of vaccination. Now, I don't know if it's just proof of vaccination or a positive test. I'm not sure. But the way it's been presented is you have to show proof of vaccination. So because he's not able to participate fully in these activities, his team, the Brooklyn Nets, said, look, Kyrie, if you're not going to be vaccinated, we can't have you just part-time. You know, you just, until you're vaccinated, you cannot play in any of our reindeer games. So Kyrie's like, look, man, I'm just trying to do what's best for me and my family, which is exactly what LeBron and Draymond Green said. But and I'm only saying that because the criticism has been that he's selfish, but the other players said we're being selfish too. They just made a different choice, you know, at the end of that selfishness. And here's what I want to ask. I hope this is a fair question, guys. And as I told you, I think being vaccinated is the safest thing you can do. The odds of something bad happening to you are very low compared to the odds of something bad happening to you by contracting full-blown COVID without any protection. Yes, you can catch COVID being vaccinated, as we've seen the breakthrough cases, but the odds of you getting really sick and dying are much lower if you have that level of protection before you get COVID. So absolutely, out of the gate, it is proven that vaccinations are going to help protect you from getting gravely ill, you know. And I think there is some protection. I think there's less proof of this, of the way that it's passed on. There's a lower chance of that. Although I don't subscribe when people say, I didn't get vaccinated for me. I got it to protect others. I'm like, fuck you, motherfucker. You get vaccinated to protect yourself first. Yes, it's nice if it protects others, but you do it to protect yourself first. That is how you protect others, sure. Or that's how you don't crowd the, you know, emergency rooms or that type of thing, or take up all those resources by protecting yourself. Let's not lose sight of what it is. Okay. So here's my question. So Kyrie has had COVID. So he probably has some level of protection, some antibodies. I don't know how much. People would argue it's not as much as the vaccine. Sure. You're right. But let's not throw science out the door. There's probably some level of protection. Here's my question though. Why can't he just get tested before every game? Like, why isn't getting tested the thing that is going to enable you to play or not in that basketball game? And I'm just asking about Kyrie and his situation. Like, why does people jump to just attacking him so much? Honestly, I don't understand why he's being attacked so much. He probably will get vaccinated because that's the rules they're imposing. And it's interesting that it's only maybe three arenas that applies, you know, so you could probably play everywhere else. But I would think the most important thing, or, you know, I would say an equally important thing as getting vaccinated is to get tested. Now, I know in California, there are rules about arenas and that type of thing. I'm going to go see the Rolling Stones. In fact, they're here in California, SoFi Stadium. SoFi Stadium says you have to show proof of vaccination or you have to show a negative test result, you know, from the last 72 hours. And they even have instant testing at the stadium, which I thought is pretty cool. So that's what I mean. They're either of those in their mind is fine, vaccination or the negative test. Why is that not the case in basketball? I don't understand that. I don't understand it. I'm just putting that out as a question. If If you have a religious exemption to this or you feel strongly about it, as Kyrie, for whatever his reasons, you know, as LeBron said and Draymond said, we should respect people's reasons. Why don't we respect his reason? And why don't they just say, all right, Kyrie, you just have to take a test before every game. It's going to be a pain in the ass for you, but that's what you have to do. I don't understand why they're not doing that. Just putting that out there. Why has no one brought that up? Yes, you could participate. Just take a test every day, motherfucker. All right. We just want to know you don't have COVID. That's all. Because the point is not to pass it on. I don't think people are, no one has said, I'm afraid for Kyrie. He might get COVID and die. No, people are concerned that you might have COVID and pass it on to someone if you're not vaccinated, right? So if he gets tested, doesn't that at least alleviate that to some extent? I don't know. Just a question. Just a question I'm putting out there because, you know, I got to ask these things. Okay. Other thing that happened this week in the world of sports, interestingly enough. So John Gruden, who is the coach of the Las Vegas Raiders, was the coach, resigned last week, was forced to resign, whatever, because some emails came out. Initially, it was an email that came out like that was from 10 years ago where he communicated with the then, I think, one of the GMs or somebody who worked with the Washington football team, known, of course, as Washington Redskins back then, where he said some inappropriate things about one of the directors in the NFL. He was a black man, and he said he had some Michelin tire-sized lips or something like that. And people were mad about this. And he said, hey, I wasn't saying something racist. You know, I was, you know, I say that people that lie have rubber lips, and this is my way of describing it, whatever. Obviously lying about that or whatever. We know that. We know that Nick was being racist. But anyhow, it kind of blew over because people came to his defense that I don't think he's racist. He's never done anything racist to me. You know, he's been really nice to me. I don't think he's doing anything wrong. But howsomever, a couple of days later, and, you know, he coached the game, by the way, last Sunday. And it looked like it was all going to blow over, you know. But then all these other things came out where he called Roger Goodell, who's the commissioner of football. He called him a homophobic slur and, you know, a lot of misogynistic comments and all kinds of just nasty stuff in there. And he offered his resignation because there was just no excuse now. And then that Michelin tired lip comment looked a little differently to people. And so once again, this opens up a lot of discussions about, you know, this was said in private. And by the way, he never really apologized for this. He just said, I didn't mean to hurt anybody, which, you know, maybe with those words, he didn't mean to hurt anybody. But there's a lot of questions about what your intentions actually were. Like, let me give you an example. One of the things that was in the emails was the whole Colin Kaepernick situation. I guess they were discussing it, and I'm paraphrasing, so I may get this wrong. But I think he said, cut that fucker or something like that, that he needs to be cut from the team. So even though he wasn't in the league at the time, you know, he was a private citizen, as you're saying, in politics, he was advocating to someone who was in the league to cut Colin Kaepernick, you know, to basically, you know, keep him out. Push him out of the system. So his words actually meant a lot in those emails with a lot of the things that they said, you know. So it's interesting that a lot of people argued too, like, these were private. They were never meant to be seen. Should a person be punished for just saying, yes, they're unsavory, a lot of the things, but should they actually be punished for it when they didn't have that job and it wasn't there? Can we really label this person a certain way because of this? Okay, so here's how I feel about a lot of this. And let me put it in this term, because I think we need a term to discuss this. And you know I love words, guys. I love coming up with terms. So I have come up with a term that I call forest racism. Okay? Forest racism. What is forest racism, Larry? Well, let me explain it. Forest racism is basically this. Okay? If a racist yells nigger in the forest and no black people are around to hear it, is he still being a racist? Forest racism. I say, of course that motherfucker is racist. Yes. But many people argue, well, Nobody heard him say nigger. Well, how can he be a racist? He's not a racist unless people hear it, unless black people hear it, right? So basically the forest in this situation is the email chain. And unfortunately, you know, that the echo of this racist comment and these other comments are allowing everyone to hear it. So for now, people know that he is this thing. But it is a good question. If we had never heard it, does it make the person, you know, a racist? And how will you ever know? This is a problem, you guys. Most of the thing, and by the way, we know there is a lot more forest niggering going on that we will never know. There was a lot going on, and not just from John Gruden. But there's a lot of forest niggering going on that we will just never know. Now, and it's not just forest racism, the homophobia and all that stuff. Many of the times we're concerned with what I call bullhorn racism, bullhorn misogyny, bullhorn homophobia, that which is explicit, that which is unmistakably those things. And we tend to go after those things first, and they make a lot of noise. But it's this other one, the forest racism, misogyny, these things that to me can be even more insidious because they're harder to go after. They're harder to address, you know, to accuse somebody of it. And what is the harm of this? You know, as soon as I heard this story, it made me think of this so-called joke from years ago. I heard this when I was in college. When does a black person become a nigger? And the answer was when they leave the room. You know, and it also made me think of how a lot of people many times viewed the country as the South is racist and the North isn't or wasn't, because they base it on the Civil War where the North fought against slavery and the South fought. But sorry, guys, that ain't how the country that ain't how the country came out of that fight against slavery. It's just different types of racism. It's just like in the South had bullhorn racism. You know where a Southerner stood, you know, but in the North, those motherfuckers were some forest racists in the North. Nothing but forest racism. So much of it, and still exists to this day, you know, and the outcomes of that type of forest racism, whether it's redlining or those types of things, the segregation that happened in the North that nobody ever talked about, but happened in those neighborhoods like in Chicago, New York, Philly, some of these places, you know, where the punitive segregation, you know, where, you know, you're put into certain areas that environmentally weren't good or economically, you know, and all those types of things. All that shit was forced racism, you know, and hopefully we're coming to a time where some of this starts to become accountable because, you know, bullhorn is like, people are smarter now. It used to be that people didn't care about being bullhorn racist, especially in the 60s, man. People did not give a shit. But there's so much for people, I think, to lose these days, except for your Karens who really haven't understood the memo yet. But it's the forest racism that I think we need to be concerned with, and not just racism, instead the other things. So I will say forest racism matters, you guys. It matters. Keep an eye out for it. Because it is insidious. The way that people can speak something in front of us, but behind closed doors, they are speaking something else. There you go. That's all I got. All right. Stick around. We got a really fun subject to talk about with Jay Ellis. Lawrence, you guys. Lawrence Hive. Stick around. You're right.
This episode is brought to you by NetSuite by Oracle. The less your business spends, the more margin of money you have. I think that's pretty obvious for everyone, but actually doing it, that's easier said than done because the cost of everything is going up these days. So do the smart thing. Switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth so you can easily reduce costs and headaches. NetSuite specifically helps by reducing IT costs since it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, and cutting the costs of maintaining multiple systems since everything you need is on one suite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See for yourself how effective NetSuite can be and try it out today. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/ringer. That is netsuite.com/ringer. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
All right, welcome back, everybody. I have a couple of gentlemen on here who's kind of enterprising out there in the world, shaking things up, making things happen, reaching out to the community. And thought we'd have them on Black on the Air here. There's a podcast called Written Off where they speak with formerly incarcerated young writers with their vulnerable poems and honest stories. And it is headed by Mr. Jay Ellis, who's a producer on this. Y'all know him as Lawrence on Insecure. And, of course, Walter Thompson Hernandez, who is a writer for The New York Times and is a author of, was it The Compton Cowboys, I believe, a couple years ago. Yeah, I think so. A couple of things like that. Welcome to Black on the Air, guys. How's it going?
Hey, thanks for having us, man.
Hello, Larry.
It's nice to talk to you. Such an interesting project here. It's so specific and it sounds very, very cool. It sounds like something that would happen in the 60s, you know, this type of thing. You know, it really does, because it's a literary reach out. It's like, when's the last time we've had a literary reach out, you know, yeah, to people and that type of thing? So my hat off to you, gentlemen. So tell me how this all came together, and let's talk about it. I gave a brief description, but can you describe what you're doing out there right now? What is Written Off? And I love the double entendre there.
Yeah, man. You know, about 5 or 6 years ago, my producing partner, Aaron Bergman, he teaches creative writing classes with the organization called Inside Out Writers, here in Los Angeles County. And they teach at a couple of the juvenile halls here and some of the adult facilities. But anyway, he asked me one day, I was still on the game at the time, actually. And he asked me if I would come in a class, because he was like, yo, most of these kids watch the game. Like, they know who you are. It would blow their mind if you came in. So I was like, yeah, sure, absolutely. So I go in, and that day he uses this Kendrick Lamar song as a prompt to get all the kids to write about all the things they know. And
kind of like a stream of consciousness type of... It doesn't have to be poetic or that type of thing, but it's just getting it all out, right?
Yep. 15-minute free write. You can write in any way you want. Some wrote raps, some wrote poems, some wrote short stories. Like, they got to write in any form they wanted for 15 minutes. And then at the end of it, they're invited to stand up and read their piece. They don't have to. It's completely their choice. But they're invited to stand up and read their piece. And I was just
What was the age range of these kids, Jay?
I mean, we're probably talking 13, 12, I might even been the youngest, up to 17 was the oldest. Right. And they were kids who were in for a multitude of things. A couple of them were being tried for their fitness, which means they're being tried. The system is going through the motions of seeing if they can be tried as adults, if they're fit to be tried as adults.
Right.
So it was a big range of folks who were in there. And, you know, these are primarily Black and brown kids. Right.
Right.
And so, I walked out of that class, and each one of them, you could see them kind of stand a little bit taller and just feel a little bit more proud as they listed off all the things they knew, as they heard themselves say all the things that they knew in life. It could be Pythagorean theorem. It could be, right? It could be they understand the court system. It could be it's literally this knowledge base that they had, and you could see each of them realize that they were smarter than what they themselves thought.
And probably no one had ever asked their opinion about anything.
No one.
Or right? wanted most to hear people, from them, right? Yeah.
No one wanted. They most folks look at them and see them as a case number or a liability in some way. The DA sees them as someone that they quickly need to process. The judge sees them as someone they quickly need to discipline, right? Mm. No one looks at them and says, you seem like a smart kid. Like, what do you think got you here? You know what I mean? It just has an actual conversation with them and lets them express themselves and use their voice. Mm-hmm. So I think, Larry, I think, have you done Young Storytellers before?
No, I haven't.
Young Storytellers.
I started my career, though, at the Taper. It was their improvisational theater project. This was years ago. And mm-hmm. we went to a situation like this, like juvenile hall situation, and we did workshops with the kids and that. And we got to hear from them. And it was the same type of thing, but it wasn't a writer workshop. It was more performative, you know?
Right.
And
right.
this was years ago. So I've been involved in this type of thing before, but it was years ago, yeah. But from a different perspective, yeah.
Yeah, so a very similar thing, Young Storytellers goes inside of elementary schools here in Los Angeles County. Mm-hmm. And they're primarily in really good neighborhoods. They're some of the better elementary schools in the city, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Testing wise. And they basically take some folks in, help these kids learn how to write. They write a story. And then at the very end, some of the studios in town put on this big production where they invite the Larry Wilmores of the world and all these actors and well-known folks to come up on stage and read their pieces. And I was like, oh, this is great. I did it before. I had an amazing time. It was great.
It's kind of like the I Have a Dream Foundation, kind of what they do and work with kids and stuff. Right.
Very similar. Very similar. Mm-hmm. And so I just kept thinking to myself, oh, why aren't we doing this for young kids who no one hears their voice? Mm-hmm. And these kids, a lot of them naturally have stories to tell and they're gifted writers, right? And they are influenced very often by people who are great writers in their own right, primarily through music, but still great writers in their own way and storytellers in their own way. So Aaron and I kicked around this idea and we were like, oh, what if we got some celebs to come and read their pieces? And we did a podcast and we put their writing out to the world and just kind of uplifted their voices.
Yeah.
And Walter Thompson Hernandez was crazy enough to come along and take this ride with us. We met him in a meeting like a few months earlier. And I was like, yo, I think Walter would be great for this. And Aaron pitched him on it. And he was like, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm 100% in.
And Walter, where are these kids coming from right now? What you're doing right now? How are you choosing the individuals that you're showcasing?
Right. Well, it's the selection process, I think, was like mostly on the shoulders of Aaron and Jay and on the folks at Inside Out. And it was kind of like based on their, pre-existing relationship with like a lot of the writers. Right. So my experience was sort of that, you know, a lot of the folks were already selected and sort of like I would meet them in person and we sort of like, you know, talk for a little bit and then just start interviewing. Right. But it was interesting and really cool because like, even though like I had just sort of met a lot of these folks, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes before or half an hour before interviewing them, it almost kind of felt like, you know, me and them had already established like a rapport and kind of had already been friends for a long time. Because like, I think Jay said it kind of earlier, you know, like I said yes to this project, you know, almost immediately. Aaron emails me and kind of gives me like the rundown. I was like, I'm in, right? And I said I'm in because like in so many different ways, like I was like one of these folks at one point, you know, like I was someone who was like expelled from like five different high schools growing up, you know, I was like locked up for like a day or two in juvie, you know? So like, and kind of thinking about who I was at 13, 14 and who my friends were and kind of the creativity, right? And the artistry that like wasn't really celebrated at that age. Just kind of really steered me towards saying yes to this immediately.
Let me ask you more about that. What was happening in your life at that time, Walter? Do you remember? Like, is it a matter of getting pushed off a track or never being on a track, or what was happening? If you don't mind speaking about that time in your life,
that's a great question. I think like for me, what was happening was that like it was interesting, right? Because I had a mom who was in a PhD program at UCLA. Mm-hmm. Right. So my mom was like getting her PhD and
education was celebrated in your home, as we say.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. 100%, yes. Right. So like it wasn't that like, you know, single mom. Yes. Right. Sure. But it wasn't that I was coming from, you know, like a broken home per se. Right.
Right.
But my experience was that like you know, I was still growing up in the hood, right? Mm-hmm. Like I was still going to a school where like I had to share a textbook with like three different people. Right. So the impacts of where I was growing up was like still around. And, you know, I've always been someone who was kind of like, been kind of like wild, you know, and interested and kind of like, you know, doing different types of things. So I think like I was impacted by a lot of the things that were happening around me. So like, it wasn't that, like my mom was like trying her best, you know, she was a grad student, but also working two jobs and like had this boyfriend in the house who wasn't the best person. So me and him always kind of clashed. So kind of like, I didn't want to be home.
Right.
And so I found that love, right. And support and affection in friends of mine who kind of had similar experiences, who also didn't want to be home, who didn't have, you know, certain guidance and stuff. So mm-hmm. all that to say is that like in working on this show and hosting this show, you know, the sort of connections I had with a lot of the folks was incredibly organic, right? Mm-hmm. Like people like Candace and Jimmy and different types of people who we had on the show, who I was like, that's someone who I was best friends with, you know, when I was 13, 14. Mm-hmm. And so having these conversations was a really interesting way of sort of like reliving a lot of the experiences that I had.
Yeah. It seems to be a common theme with a lot of, I'll use the word kids, you know, the young people who go down a certain track, you know, like that theme of identity and wanting to belong to a group and where you feel like you belong to something that feels like family because there's something going on with your family. It seems to be a common theme. And you know, I always say there are always rotten apples that's probably where they should be, you know, but they're always, yeah. There's the good bunch that it's hard not to be in that because that magnetic pull is so, right. It's so strong depending on your surroundings, you know, like that's why I wanted to ask you, because obviously your mom, you didn't have education deprivation. You had environment deprivation, which is different, you know, it's those, which pull can be the strongest and how can you be protected? You know, it's interesting that there's so much commonality in that with a lot of these kids, and all they need is that little door open to that. Sure. To that other lane, right?
Yeah, and I know, like we were talking about music earlier, right? It's almost like a Kendrick Lamar sort of thing, right? Like,
sure, who's from Compton?
Right? Yeah, who's from Compton? You right. know, and like a Kendrick Lamar to me is a perfect example of a lot of these folks who are in this show. You know, Good Kids, Mad City, right? And like that is like, I don't think any of these folks, like I don't think any of us are like born with the need or drive to like want to do like, you know, bad shit out in the world,
right.
You know, or like do this and do that. It's just that, you know, we're really impacted by the experiences around us. And I think for me, it was almost like I had to sort of like prove myself in like a really interesting way. Right. Cause I have mm-hmm. a mom who's at UCLA, you know, getting her PhD in literature, and none of my friends have that experience. So like on one hand, like I'm trying to sort of like, you know, do more than my friends are doing because I'm trying to prove myself to like, you know, to like a group of friends who you know, really supported me.
Tell me about, Jay, tell me about some of the writers that you guys have showcased so far.
Yeah, man. I mean, what an amazing group of folks. You know, to Walter's point earlier, Candace, who, I mean, her piece is absolutely amazing. Kiki Palmer read her piece. Mm-hmm. And it was about love. And it was about like how love could change her life ultimately. I mean, Walter would probably do a better job of telling it than I can because he sat and talked with her. But it was ultimately about how like a hug and some affection and love go such a long way. And like that is how you build a community and how you build and make folks stronger, and especially young folks, as opposed to like the tough, hard, you know, regimented, do this, do that. Jimmy Wu, who is actually ILW's executive director, has such a powerful story. Jimmy spent, Walter, is it 13 years in jail?
I think so, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, he spent 13 years in jail. He was actually ILW's very first student, like 20 something years ago, when he was a 16, 17 year old kid in jail. Then went and spent 13 years and then came out, bounced around for a little bit, and then landed at ILW and has now been there for a while and has become the executive director. But his story is, I mean, the ups and the downs, man. And they again, talking about, like, to Walter's point, talking about somebody who doesn't come from a broken home, right? He had his mom and dad in the house and a younger brother in the house.
Crazy.
And just, you know, I think Well, Walter, you probably remember this too. I mean, you grew up out here, but I think about the 90s and growing up in the 90s, and it was just like, how could you not want to be a part of that? Like the homies just looked
boys
so
in the hood,
cool,
yeah.
And they were always together and they had rides, and like it was just such a it was such an attractive thing. Yeah. And like there was, you know, the flamboyance and the charisma and the music and everything about it was so appealing. Whether you had one parent at home or whether you had both parents at home, it was still something that you kind of saw as like, damn, that is cool. That is the definition of cool. And Jimmy is someone who kind of fell into that in his own way, even though he had both of his folks.
A lot of kids of color don't have the privilege of being able to compartmentalize thug life. you know what I mean? They don't have the privilege of being able to compartmentalize that, where it's just singing it in the shower, and then they're off to the clean suburbs, right?
You know, it was such a way of life. You know what I mean?
Like absolutely.
It's wild. But yeah, man, we had such a really talented group. I mean, Kyle, who Walter got to talk to, Kyle was in fire camp at the time. So Kyle had been in jail for about eight or nine years at this point. And Kyle started out in a medium security, and then, you know, had for good behavior partially and population control partially, he got put bumped down to the lowest level of security in the state of California, which is actually fire camp. We send folks, a lot of folks don't know this, but in the state of California, we send folks who are incarcerated to go fight fires, right? We train them to go fight fires and send them as first responders to fires. And so some big, massive ones. And so Kyle was in fire camp and Walter got to talk to him. And it was wild. And Aaron got to talk to him as well. And that was wild because, you know, we went through, you hear the collect call. You are getting a collect call from the state of California department. We went through and then the call drops and then you got to pick it up. And then he only has so much time on Tuesday. So then you got to wait till he gets his next call on Wednesday to finish the interview. So that was also, you know, I think just such a testament to like Walter and to our producers and to Lemonada, our partner on this, of like putting this all together with like knowing that, you know, it wasn't easy to get this conversation. Sure.
I was struck listening to one where it might have been Jimmy, where it talking about how difficult it is to reach someone depending on how much time they're serving. You know, like if you're in there for a long amount of time, you're more susceptible to having your life changed than if you know you're going to be out there soon. You could go back to your old habits or something. Mm-hmm. There's so many challenges, you know, just to getting to open ears, you know.
Yeah.
Who are some of the people that you guys are trying to reach with this? Like who would you like to hear this? I mean, there are probably different types of audiences you're going for, not just one type, I would think, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we want anyone, if you've ever had anyone who's been impacted by the system, like I think we want you to hear it. If you have ever not hired someone because of their criminal record or their past, like we want you to hear it. If you think that just because someone's ever been to juvenile hall that they're a lost cause and they're never going to get on the right track, we want you to hear it. And at the same time, you know, we wanted people in town in LA to hear it. Like we wanted someone at Universal or someone at Sony or, you know, an executive somewhere to be like, oh my God, I love that story. That story could be an amazing movie, or that story could be an amazing book or a short film or whatever it may be. And we wanted, you know, to give our writers an opportunity. Like they're all passionate about writing and this is something that they all love and they want to continue to do. So we wanted to make sure that like folks who could help or who would be interested in helping further their careers and developing their voices and uplifting their voices also got a chance to listen to these stories.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, my father was a probation officer growing up, so I was very familiar with the camps that these kids are at and that type of thing. And ironically, both of my sisters at one point were in juvenile hall. You know, I mean, that's the way families work, right? You know, I'll never forget that. The irony about, I think this, which is why I'm a comedy writer primarily, you know, the irony of ironies. But I'm very familiar with how kids can just get in there and just be lost and forgotten and that type of thing. And the only people that directly care about them are the people that are actually taking care of them in the camps.
And what's wild for a lot of these kids too is like they go in and, you know, if you're doing a year and a half, 2 years in juvie and you're coming from, if you are coming from an unstable situation, there is a chance that the court system doesn't know how to get a hold of your parents once it is time for you to go home. Then that becomes a whole nother system. And so to your point, like the folks that are around them, whether they're in these camps or whether they're in these halls, like they do become very influential and very important to shaping, you know, who that person could potentially be and getting them back on that right, getting them back on a path once they get to go home.
Walter, what were some of the biggest surprises for you coming into this project? Did anything kind of hit you in a way that you didn't expect or kind of open your eyes to anything?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I was expecting, you know, a lot of great art, right? Like a lot of great writing and a lot of great poetry. And I think we all heard that. What I didn't expect for me personally was like the impact of these stories and like how sort of, you know, like I think sometimes we try to sort of compartmentalize, right? Things, experiences and traumas in our life that we have experienced and like have had to move on. And I think so many of us are so busy, right? That we have to sort of like find a way to sort of like push forward. But for me, you know, listening to Jimmy Woo, to Jimmy Valdez, to Candace, like I was just like, it just sort of reminded me of, you know, just how sort of precarious I think the realities for a lot of folks are. And I think, you know, just how lucky a lot of us are, you know, if we're being really honest here. And
absolutely.
Just I think how much more work has to be done in terms of like, you know, erasing a lot of these stigmas for folks who've been incarcerated, right? And I think it wasn't that it was a surprise for me, but it was just a reminder, right? That you know, I think so many of these folks like should not be judged on a single act, right? I think all of us, right? Like we are so much more than like one sort of error that we committed, right? And I think like that was surprising for me, just how much of an impact these stories would have on me and how much it would like kind of like force me to revisit, you know, a lot of the experiences I had growing up in LA. And like Jay said earlier, you know, I think for a lot of us who grew up in the 90s in LA, like, you know, whether it was gangs or graffiti or whatever it was, like, it all just seemed so sort of like lucrative and exciting and interesting. And I think it just made me sort of reflect on the experiences of growing up in Los Angeles. And also, you know, for a lot of us who grew up here, like just how lucky we all were to have survived the 90s, right? Like I was born in 1985, I'm 36 now, right? So I was kind of like, you know,
just a baby.
Yeah, right. But you know what I mean though? Like I was sort of like 95, 96, I was like 10, 11 now, but that was sort of peak 90s. And like, even me seeing and surviving the 90s to me, I was like, damn, you know, I don't know how I did it, but I'm here. And I know that a lot of folks who are in this show also maybe feel the same way too.
What has been the stickiness rate on people in terms of doing this? Have many of them done it more as a therapeutic exercise, or have you seen some of them saying, well, this could be a vocation. This is something I actually want to do.
Yeah. I think it's kind of a combination of both, right? Like I think for a lot of folks, particularly off camera, you know, there was a sort of like feeling that I got that this was incredibly therapeutic for a lot of people. I think, you know, a lot of these folks have done really amazing work with IOW and have sort of expressed like different vulnerabilities and open up in ways that you know, writing on a piece of paper, I think allows us to enter a world where we're not judged, right? Where it's like, you know, we can be honest with ourselves because it's just somebody and a piece of paper. And I think nearly everyone expressed that, right? Where it's like writing becomes an act of therapy and an act of like resilience, right? Where so much can happen, but also, I think, you know, some folks who we interviewed, you know, want to pursue writing and want to pursue, you know, the arts. And also some other folks are doing other things, which is also fine. You know, I think someone like Jimmy, right, who doesn't really write as much as he used to, doesn't maybe have the same sort of like literary aspirations.
Sure.
But still uses writing as a way to reconnect with himself. And I think a lot of folks also feel the same way.
Has there been a discovery of worlds for a lot of these people that, hey, there's this literary world that exists out here that is yours for the taking. There's a Chester Himes out there. There's Richard Wright. There's James Baldwin. There's Maya Angelou. You know, there's all the Nikki Giovanni, some of her poems. You know, there's all these voices that I think maybe people weren't even aware of that were speaking some of the same things, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, no, no, definitely. You know, I think there's like, I think in like, whether it's like the TV and films, like TV and film space or the literary space or like whatever sort of world it is, I think there's like a need for authenticity. You know, I think like there's a premium on authentic stories and stories that sort of are built on real experiences. And I think everyone in this show kind of, you know, is writing from a place where like they are the experts of their own story. Right. And I think like there's such a premium on what they're creating because like these are coming from very real experiences. And I think you can't really replicate that.
Do you guys think just looking at the culture in general, not just this particular group, like where's writing in the culture right now? Are we kind of losing that? Do you think? I mean, we're in such a texting culture and like, you know, the thing, I feel like, you know, that's why I had to give you guys credit. I'm like, writing, like what young people even know what writing is, for Christ's sakes, you know, and it's not required of anybody anymore.
Yeah, it's wild, especially when you think about, like, I think about even little things like they don't teach cursive anymore. And I'm like, wait,
exactly.
Why did I spend all this time?
Why did I suffer?
But I'm grateful for learning cursive now. Yes. Like, you know what I mean? I'm like,
exactly.
But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm probably in a bit of a bubble in a way where, right, mm-hmm. like we deal, I know so many writers.
Right.
Whether it is friends who write in TV and film or whether it's folks who write for publications and magazines and newspapers or whatever, or whether it's folks who, you know, are in the literary world and they're writing books. So I am often surrounded by writers. I will say there's a writing group that I meet with out here in LA. We try to get together once a month and I'm the oldest one in the group. I'm turning 40 in December and I'm the oldest one in the group and the youngest one is like 25. So I do think, I think there is always going to be like, I hope it continues to grow more, to be honest. But I think there's something Walter said earlier, like the ability to reconnect with yourself and not be judged. And whether you want to put that away and it's just for you or whether you want to share it with the world, I do think there is space for it because I do think people want that authenticity. They want that connection. They want to be grounded. They want to tell a story. They want their voice to be heard in some way. And sometimes that voice isn't like just in 150 or 140 characters, whatever Twitter is. And sometimes, you know what I mean? Sometimes it is that. And sometimes it's like, oh, I got something a little bit more that I want to say. And I think we'll see that continue and hopefully grow more. I will say our young folks, a lot of times, or the young folks at IOW rather, most of them will tell you they can write a rap. Most of them will be like, hey, I can write 16 bars. I got you.
Right.
But then when you sit them down and you give them, you know, a reading from Baldwin or you give them a quote or you give them something as a prompt and you sit them down to go write, you see that like all of a sudden they're taking this like skill that they have a feeling of and they kind of have their hands around and being able to write a couple verses and you see that expand into a story. And you see that expand into a poem or into something, you know, a little bit more substantial. And I think that like, if we can continue to show folks that like, even with this little thing that you love so much,
right,
you can do something so much larger with it. I think we'll hopefully see even more and more folks be pulled into writing.
I think Jay is absolutely right. And I also think that like, I don't think writing is going anywhere, but I also think that our ideas of what writing looks like and even what a writer looks like has changed.
Right.
I said earlier that like, this is like a 1960s show, right? Where it's like, you know, probably white dude on like a typewriter, right? Like writing in some like mountain cabin escape, right? And it's pipe. Like, yeah, exactly. You know, smoking a pipe. And I think like our ideas of what a writer looks like and how a writing has changed. Like, I don't mean personally, like I wrote a book mostly on my phone. Right. Which is kind of like a crazy idea. And I feel like young folks are kind of taking writing and applying it in different ways. And we're not sort of having to like sit down on a typewriter anymore, and maybe our writing is changing, but the sort of existential, you know, questions that we're asking while we're writing, I think that's universal, and like that's not going away anytime soon.
Do you have hope that there'll be more Walter Thompsons coming up, people that want to do this types of things from this circle, or they're just, who knows where these people are going to be springing up from?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I think there's only like one of me, and there's only one of you, and there's only like
No, just kidding.
but I do think that it's like, you know, we're always trying to build on like what folks did,
right,
you know, 10, 15 years ago. And I think, you know, it's our turn for only a limited amount of time. And like, we don't have like the platforms or the space or like people caring about what we have to say or write about or direct or whatever it is. And I think like, you know, it's just like kind of building on past experiences and legacies. Mm-hmm. And that's all we could really do.
Jay, how do you make something like writing sexy? You know, like where does the sexiness come in? You know what I mean? Like when you talk about rap, to me, the sexiness is in the performance of it, you know, but there is a sexiness in having to come up with bars in the moment, you know, and you know, and raising your game each time, you know, you're coming, you're versing or whatever it is, you know, there is a sexiness in that if you know how to do that. But how do you, you know, imbue a sexiness to writing itself to young people that may not know that there is a romantic, there is a romanticism in this. It is a gateway to something, you know. Like if you look at sports, like baseball to me, like when people talk about baseball's not doing enough to get back people in baseball, to me it's the opposite problem. Baseball just isn't sexy anymore to black people the way it used to be. You know, it doesn't have that sex appeal that it used to have, where the sex appeal now is in more in the other sports, especially basketball, where basketball really exploits the personalities of players more than any other sport, probably, you know.
Yeah.
And it feels more current, you know, where baseball almost feels 19th century, let alone 20th century, you know. And that's what I mean about like writing when I talk about the arcane nature of it, you know, like, can it have a certain romanticism with young people?
I think so. I think when you think about folks like, and now I just lost her name. It was on the tip of my tongue, but the young woman who spoke at inauguration.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Amanda Gorman.
Yeah, I'm the worst person to recall names.
Right, she's brilliant. Yes, thank you. She's brilliant, right? Thank you, Walter. And I think you look at someone like that. I think she's made writing sexy.
That's a
right?
good point.
Like she's very clearly not only did she go do that at that age, but then she was on the cover of 267 million magazines in the same week, right? And I think all of a sudden, young folks are like, "Oh, she's speaking her truth, unedited, right? She is unedited speaking her truth." How can I not be attracted to that? Like, why? You know what I mean? I think something like that is like, because for so long, I think, especially like, I think when the three of us were probably taught writing, it was always very much in a box. You write like this, and it has to do that. And it has to be a subject and a predicate. It has to follow all these things, right? And like, there were so many rules around it and how a story had to end, and right? And I think, while that is still the classic way of storytelling, like we are now seeing that like there are millions of ways that you can tell your story and it can still have insane impact and still have your voice, be imbued with your voice and your point of view. And it doesn't have to feel edited. It doesn't feel like you have to compromise or tell less than you wanted to tell. And I think that is sexy. I think the freedom of that is sexy.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's also, I think what I remember and you know, about the 90s, for example, right, is that I feel like it wasn't cool when I was growing up, like, to be a nerd, right? To be, like, like weird, right? To be, like, a geek or whatever. And I feel like, so, you know, for a lot of us, like, we kind of had to hide that version of us, right? Like, I was that kid, like, in the back of class who knew every answer, right, to every question, but kind of, like, put my hand down because, like, I don't want to not get the girls, right? And I feel like now there's kind of been like a cultural shift where it's kind of, there's more space for a lot of folks of color, right? To like be weird, like it's like cool being a nerd now. And so I feel like we are kind of in that renaissance where we're like, you know, whether it's like creating things or like being weird or being a writer, or being whatever, like it's kind of celebrated in ways that it wasn't back in the days.
Look at how happy do you think I am? Look how long I had to wait. What are you gonna say, Jay?
I feel like dudes like Pharrell and Andre 3000 opened the door, right?
Yeah.
Like I think they opened the door, and because that is where our community often goes first, is to hip hop, right? Into music, rather. Like I feel like those dudes opened the door for us that I don't know if like their contribution will ever be recognized in the way that it should, because. And I think, like, while I am not on that camp now, like, I think even early Kanye, like, being the polo rapper, you know what I mean? Like, those guys at that time creating these
different... certainly nerd expression, Kanye, for sure, where he was a cool nerd,
I think, like, they opened the door in a way that, like, you know, and I'll give, I think there's someone else, like, you know, when you look at Dope, when you look at, like, Rick's work with that character, like, that young boy being a nerd with a nerd group of friends in the hood, like stuff like that, I feel like really opens the door, and you still get your Rocky ASAP. So you still get the dude that we all saw in the 90s. And we were like, damn, like he got the chain and the girl and whatever.
Right.
But also you look at the nerds and you're like, oh, but they cool too. And also they kind of cooler, cause they're like into a very specific thing. And that thing is actually really cool. And like, I think that really has opened the door in a lot of way for folks.
Yeah, my generation.
To just be them.
It was a little more practical because when I was coming up, it was hard to get our individual voices across. You had to fit into the Hollywood mode. Mm. So I was inspired by my peers, Spike and Keenan doing Lemon Color, you know, all these people who we said, fuck this shit. We're just going to do our own thing, you know, and that's what. Like for me, propelled me, even though I had been writing before, it really put it front and center. The only way to have true independence and make your mark is you have to be a writer. You have to, as I call it, you know, you have to control the narrative, which now I think younger people are understanding, especially in our business, Jay, show business, about controlling that narrative, whether it's working with Issa, who understood that very early on, or there's so many of us now, you know, there were so few when I was starting this, or so few in recognizing that that had to be done if you want to have any kind of say in what the stories are, you know, it's so powerful.
And to your point, look at like Black Girl Nerds right now, Issa Rae has created, and to your point, she did it with writing. Like she very
Shonda is another one. Yeah, she hit that mark first because she came out completely as a nerd with Grey's Anatomy, you know, this type of thing. It wasn't like when Yvette Bowser had, God, I just forgot Yvette's show, but you know, the...
Living Single?
Yeah, when Yvette hit Living Single, even though Yvette, you could say, is that type of person too. She went to Stanford, you know, she's this type of person, you know, she's a lot like Issa in that way. But, you know, she was presenting in this different mode where it was this relatable Black experience type of thing. No one would put it in this other category where, you know, where Shonda had to be reckoned with in a different way. You know, I guess you could say she couldn't be dismissed that Hollywood likes to do, you know, power and expression. And you guys have gotten many actors and stuff to participate in this, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, we had a really great group of folks. Man, my fingers will work, and I text everybody. And I will say, everyone said yes right out the gate, which is amazing. Like, you know, we had Issa, we had John Legend, Yvonne Orji, Karamo Brown, Angelique Cabral, Danny Ramirez,
Randall Park.
Randall Park. Mm-hmm, we had just such a great group of folks. Jesse Williams. We just had such a great group of folks who lent their time, their talent, and opened their hearts. And what's amazing is like every single one of them, after I sent them the piece, hit me back and they were like, yo, if you ever need me again, please like just send me stuff, because they were all, I don't want to say so impressed. I think to like what Walter said earlier, I think it hit something in them that they had probably compartmentalized themselves at some point. Just with the day-to-day of life, and it just opened this thing back up and made them, it took them back to a place and a time in their own lives, I think, in a way.
That's
and
great.
So it was really, it was great. They're a great group of folks.
Have you guys heard from the audience? What has the reaction been out there in the world?
Really great responses. I think like, you know, a lot of folks who I know have, you know, have texted me, have called me and, you know, have really enjoyed the show. I think for a lot of people, it's like, we all know folks like that, whether like we are that person, but we all know somebody who's incredibly talented, you know, at something, who, you know, oftentimes doesn't get a platform to, you know, share their story. And so I think that from my end, the responses have been really positive. And, you know, a lot of folks have been really drawn to the stories, and you sort of pair that with like the celebrity angle, you know, it creates a really positive experience for a lot of folks.
That's awesome. Well, I really appreciate you guys coming on and talking about this. I just think it's really it's just such a cool project, you know. It just seems like there's so many possibilities with it and places that it can, you know, rise to or expand to and that type of thing. Jay, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you about how you feel about Insecure, man. Congratulations, by the way. It's such a great run. You know, I always hate using this word with some people, but I have to. I'm so proud of you, man. You know, seeing where you started on this and just watching you and you as a man and what you're doing out there producing and the whole cast, man. When I think of where that started and where it is now, it's amazing. What's the journey been like for you, the Insecure journey?
It's crazy, man. Like, I don't even know if I could really put it into words yet. I think I'm still trying to like figure it all out for myself. You know, it has been, it's amazing. You know, you go to work every single day with these folks and everyone is so talented and so gracious and so kind. And also like, you don't get, there are no days off. Everyone is like so good at what they do, whether it is as a performer or as a writer. It makes you get better. Like, you are constantly inspired. It's the iron sharpens iron, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's literally the quote from the Bible, like the verse from the Bible. Like, literally, you are becoming a better person every single day, and you are inspired to be a better creator and search for truth and authenticity. In a way that, like, I just don't know if you get that on other shows sometimes. And then to be able, you know, to have the support of HBO has been amazing. Such an amazing partner. To be able to learn so much from Issa and Princess and you and Melina. Like, there's so many people who were involved in this show. And you look at their careers, where they started, where they're at now, and how they have kind of really opened the doors for folks. And you look back and you go like, oh, how could I not do the same thing when I get that opportunity? And I think like that is something that I've also taken away from this. And then like the last thing I think is like having the opportunity to play Lawrence Walker, who is a dude who we rarely get to see on screen that often. We don't get to see a young Black man who is vulnerable, who doesn't necessarily know how to express himself, who is trying to find how to be a better person or make better decisions, but often because he's living between his ears and like not conversating and having conversation rather and communicating with folks, he's kind of making bad decisions. Like, we don't really get to see that guy that often. We don't really get to talk about the young Black dude who's depressed because he went to college and then he got out and he was like, I'm about to be popping. And then all of a sudden there was no opportunity for him. So I know so many of my boys who have been through that. I went through that. I graduated from college thinking like, oh, I'm about to get all the jobs. I moved to LA. I moved to LA and walked through Beverly Hills. Like, yo, somebody's about to make me. There's an agent right now walking down the street who's about to find me. Nobody was there. No, they were all in their office working. And so like, you know, I just know my own story, like so many friends of mine who have gone through such a similar journey. And so like, it is an honor to be able to tell that story and to be able to play that character, because I think he is like such a relatable, he's an everyman. I think there is a lot of like, there's so many of us who have gone through aversion in the relationship stuff, in the work stuff, depression, after a breakup, trying to be a playboy or being out there on your whole phase, whatever it is. There's so many of us who have gone through versions of that. And so I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. One of the things that I really loved what you guys did too with the show is it's, you know, Issa and Molly, we know we're going to see the different ups and downs and the emotions of the relationship. But for Lawrence, for your character, for us to be able to watch a character like yours and experience heartbreak, you know, and it's not just one-sided. Normally it's one-sided, but to see it, And to me, there was different types of heartbreak. I'll never, one of my favorite things is when you have no idea that you're striking out at that pitch. I think it was season three. I'm like, oh my God, this is heartbreaking, you know? And it's like, that was great, right? And you're in that environment. Cause that was about Hollywood too, you know, and about so many things. Oh, my whole body was like, oh, you know? But the way you, man, your character wore those things with such an innocence too, which even made it more heartbreaking in some ways. You know, do you have any favorite moments from the show or anything that stands out? Any particular instance that stands out, you go, man, that was like, that was, ugh.
Yeah, you know, that's a good one. That woo-woo moment is a good one where he's pitching it, because I do believe, to your point, you're also talking about like one up in a room. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
What, right?
That's so a big also, part of it, by the way. Yeah.
It's a huge part of it. So like the pressure and the burden of that on top of, oh, I think I'm coming in with this pitch that they're gonna love.
Exactly.
And then you're like, wait, then you have to question yourself in a lot of ways. Cause then you go, is my pitch actually bad, or do they not understand the pitch because of what I look like and who I am? So then all of a sudden you end up in this weird space. And like, if you have not gone through that, you will go through that. Like we, as a person of color, it is almost like a rite of passage. You, at some point, that is something that you will go through. And so, you know, and for him, obviously, it was fine in that it was his pitch and the environment, but more importantly, the pitch. But I look at that. I that's a moment that always stands out to me. I think 408 with Issa and Lawrence last year, that whole night of them, they're kind of before sunset, after sunset, before sunrise moment, that whole episode, I still think it's one of the most romantic episodes of half hour television I've ever seen in my life. And I know I'm biased, but I truly believe it. I think the finale of season two was super powerful.
Yeah.
Obviously the finale of season one was its own, you know,
I'm getting chills. The Twitter
sphere blew up on that. And the Lawrence Hive was created.
So that's true. Absolutely was the Lawrence Hive. It came out of that whole thing. Any spoilers coming up for this final season? Anything?
I mean, you know, we're going to watch him learn what being a father is. Maybe, you know, I think it's really, to be very real, you know, Condola posed this thing to him of like, you can be as involved or uninvolved as you want. Like, I won't hold it against you. And I think we are now going to watch Lawrence walk that line and like figure out what that means. Again, I think, the one kind of like spoiler I'll give is like, we know Lawrence always wants to do the right thing.
Yes, definitely.
We know he wants to do the
right
thing.
Yes.
It's usually the way he goes about doing the right thing that becomes the problem. And so I think that's what we'll get to see him battle with this season.
That's awesome. Walter, what's up next for you? Doing more of these types of things. What else are we going to see? By the way, I want to ask you, Compton Cowboys, what an interesting book. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts of that being a film or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, man. Searchlight bought the rights to that film like right when we signed the book deal 2 years ago. And there's been like three scripts, I think, now at this point. So it's doing well. Personally, like, I've been really more into TV and film. Like, I have a film, Sundance, coming out this year that I wrote and directed. Working on the next book, which is due in February. It's like a memoir, actually, about like 90s LA, about me and my mom.
I love that.
I'm
That's awesome.
So I'm transitioning more to like TV and film stuff. And it's been really cool to be able to like, you know, go from like journalism to like audio to like TV and film now. So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, gentlemen. Like I said, I really applaud taking this tack. And, you know, it's so easy for these kids to be invisible in our world, especially these days where there's so much emphasis on flash of people on Instagram and showing, you know, living your best life, you know, and some people are in situations, you know, that are just unfortunate, you know, and they don't have an outlet. They don't have people that would care to reach out to them, you know, and show them that, hey, you matter too. It's very powerful what you guys are doing. I just want to give you props for that. You know, even no matter what happens to them, this will touch them in a way that will have an effect, you know, and it may jump to that next generation where they're able to give that thing. So it is a gift, gentlemen, is what I'm saying, you're doing. So congratulations. Written Off is the name of the podcast. And where can they find it?
Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcast.
It's Jay Ellis and Walter Hernandez. Thanks for being on Black on the Air, guys.
Thanks, man.
Insecure! Final season coming up, you guys!